Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I am looking for a book to enjoy during Women's History Month. To help me are two gentlemen.
We're soliciting opinions of all white men today.
Oh boy. And nice. So who more qualified than two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe?
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning, Joe.
good morning, Litheads.
Good morning, everybody.
Immediately when it comes out. Good morning, everybody. My name is Joe Holshue. And Nick, if you are looking for a book to enjoy here at the end of Women's History Month, I have a book I enjoyed very, 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 very much. It is
Holy
becoming.
Cow.
Yeah, it's four varies.
Did you get those varies in bulk or what?
When I was in school, no, I won't tell that story. I enjoyed it very, very, I enjoyed it tremendously. It is the book Becoming, the memoir from Michelle Obama. I think I might be the last person to have read this, so I'm not sure if this is recommendation as so much as just, hey, guys, remember how good that book was?
I haven't read it either, so I'm eager to hear.
I have not read it either.
All right.
So there are at least two people in the world. Perfect. And that would be Nick and myself.
And Ian.
Yeah. Greetings and salutations to you, Mr. Joe. Greetings and salutations to you, Mr. Nick. I want to wish you guys a very happy National Vietnam War Veterans Day on March 29th. That's today. I hope you guys have some awesome celebrations planned for that. Nick, if you're looking for a good, awesome book to cap off your Women's History Month, a book to maybe teach you a little something about women's history and women who made history with their DNA, let me recommend Rebecca Skloot's nonfiction science mystery story, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
See, now that's a good title. Like, sometimes you've brought titles, Ian, that are a little bit hard to remember, like the Horcrux for Leibovitz, right? Like,
you got the last part.
A canicle for Harry Potter. That was the other one that you brought.
The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, it's a great title, and it kind of...
Is Henrietta still with us, I assume?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, and in a way, she's still alive and is immortal. In another way, she died in 1951 of cervical cancer. So,
okay. Oof. Well, that ended in an unfunny way. I think everybody's read your book, Joe.
Everybody?
It seems like a very popular book.
It's very popular.
Joe, do you have like any anxiety when you do popular books that people are sort of not fact-checking you, but sort of, fans of the book? They're like listening along and saying, oh, does he talk about this? Oh, he didn't talk about that.
That's a great question. I've gone through life assuming that my opinion on everything is canonical, like is the final word on the matter.
That helps. So, that clears it right up.
Yeah. Concerning. So, okay. So we'll cut that out.
or you could leave it in.
I got no small talk for you guys. I feel very unqualified to talk about these books.
Well, I think we are.
I guess I don't need to be, though. Shouldn't you guys be talking about them?
Let me just quickly go to Spotify.gov and look at the description of the podcast. It does say that it's our job to talk about the books here, so I do think that we can do that. I want to tell you guys that this is the second time I've brought a book to the podcast, which was made into a film starring Oprah Winfrey. And I think that we need to extend, Oprah is big in the world of books, and also just like she's one of those celebrities who's a one-name celebrity. So I'm wondering like how we can sort of ask her to be our friend and to tell people about our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are all really good ideas. Well, here's the thing. Michelle Obama is also associated with Oprah, right? So maybe if we get Michelle Obama on the podcast first, she can put in a good word for
absolutely.
Oprah. Absolutely. Yes. Like, I think maybe that, like, we can, like, right. backdoor it.
I think we can say right now, Litheads, if any of you happen to have Oprah Winfrey's personal contact information or even like her agent, we would love to kind of start that dialogue. But I think having former First Lady Michelle Obama as our backup is great.
I like how Joe's approach to getting this huge megastar is getting another huge megastar.
Right. Yes.
Maybe arguably a more famous person.
Speaking of which, the relationship.
If it's too hard to get a hold of Michelle, maybe we can just reach out to Barack Obama directly. And then he can put in a good word for Michelle, and then Michelle can eventually get us for Oprah. Yes. I see a lot of different ways. We can talk about this off air.
Qualified cohorts. Before we get started, let's go over our show rules here. Sure, the lit heads are dying to hear that. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers, Ian. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. Words. It's the only thing that's important here on the show. So, Joe, would you like to go first, please? Just
absolutely.
Take 30 seconds and tell me about your book. Well, it's not your book. Well, it's a book that you're presenting.
I feel like you've started the timer and you're trying to bogart my time.
No. I just want to hear about the book.
Michelle Obama's 450-page memoir. It starts as a young girl growing up working class on the south side of Chicago and ends with her final days in the White House. We meet her family, see her education at Princeton and Harvard Law, see multiple careers, sit in with her during her romance with Barack, and finally watch as she figures out how to maximize her impact as First Lady. It's a middle-class story, but more than anything, it's what it's like to be an intelligent, driven, hyper-competent woman in fields dominated by men. Becoming has a lot of wisdom. And that has to be my 30 seconds, right? Like that. Like I'm not going to finish this.
This is fun. I like for Joe to think that he's got less time than normal.
Yep.
But still just listen to him take up like double the amount of allotted time. So no consequence.
So as a teacher, I usually just talk until the bell rings and then students get up and leave. So I just talk until the bell rings, Nick.
Should we change our buzzer to a bell?
Yes. Oh, of course it should.
Oh, shoot.
How are we 40 darn. Episodes into this and haven't thought of that?
I don't know. You guys hear it like 8 times a day. Why didn't you bring that up? Anyway, Ian, do you want to tell me about your book in 30 seconds or less? Feel free to go heavy on plot, or you can skip it and get to the metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Immortality.
In 1951, scientists at Johns Hopkins took a tissue sample from a woman named Henrietta Lacks without asking her permission. Cell cultures from that tissue sample have revolutionized medical research, but Lacks was forgotten almost immediately. This book tells her story for the first time, alongside the story of how her DNA changed science and her family's quest to establish Henrietta's global legacy. This book is 381 pages and published in 2010.
Yeah, you get to go first. I want to hear about this so much. This is one of the most fascinating things in science, in my opinion, ever. Like, so this is crazy.
They stole her cells.
Do you know this? Nick, do you know this story?
I know anecdotally the story of how, like you just said, like what it's her DNA that has like is basically like patient zero on like all these medical breakthroughs and how like we're still using it to like cure things. That's awesome. That's the extent of my knowledge.
Okay, good. So I can still surprise and dazzle you.
Delight me, Ian.
Okay, great.
And Joe, you can also surprise and delight Joe.
Okay. I am ready to be surprised and delighted.
Okay, do I have clearance to surprise and delight the litheads, or should I hold off?
We actually are going to need a permission form from each and every lithead for that.
And the office is closed. Oh boy.
They come here to be informed, not surprised nor delighted.
You guys sound like idiots. Ian, can you tell me about your book?
Sure. I'm going to start part of the drill draw of this book is just the crazy, crazy story. So I'm going to kind of run down the story briefly.
Please do.
This is nonfiction. This is akin to another book which I brought from 2010 called The Warmth of Other Suns, in that it is written in a narrative nonfiction style. So it's like winsome and enjoyable and kind of, I mean, it's like new journalism-esque. It's along the same lines of the In Cold Blood or The Right Stuff.
Both previous winners on the show brought by me.
Exactly.
Whose perspective is this book from?
Well, so part of it is this omniscient third person sort of narrating the life of Henrietta and her family. But there's also a good bit of the author, Rebecca Skloot herself, because part of the draw of this story is her research process.
So, Ian, start us off from square one. What square is one. Going okay. on?
So the story, like I mentioned, has three strands. One strand is the result of Skloot's research. And this is like Henrietta Lack's life story. So she was a black woman born in on the East Coast in Virginia, and lived to be 31, had a bunch of children starting really young. It was in extreme poverty, had a virulent and somewhat rare strain of cervical cancer, and went to Johns Hopkins, which had free cancer treatment. And while she was being treated there, scientists there took a tissue sample from the cancer mass, and they did not ask her permission. Now, this is
really
So this is something which is, it's important to note that in 1951, no one asked for permission to take samples, but also the next part of the story makes this not asking for permission a little more egregious. So there was this attempt to a kind of a long-term scientific attempt to keep cells alive and keep them kind of self-replicating, living basically living tissue outside of a human body, but they couldn't do it. And her now, Ian, cells.
You're a doctor. How do they do that?
Well, actually, I learned a good bit. I couldn't like keep a hobbit's cells alive, but I could probably do my best towards keeping a human cells alive. This is one of the positive points about this book. There's a lot of really complex biotechnical science, and it explains it pretty well. But so the sort of research establishment can't keep cells alive as cultures, and Henrietta Lacks tissue sample they managed to keep alive, and it grew, and it became the base. That one sample became the base for replication, because these are cancer cells. They grow super, super fast, and that means they're really, really good for testing various medications, like recombinations and DNA tests. And this is where the science gets a little bit too much for me. But the point is, having cell cultures that grow this fast became just hugely important for the American research medical boom between 1955 and 1985 or so. Continuing, I guess you could say.
Okay, so can I ask, we're never going to understand how that scientifically works. Does the book try to explain it? Like, you get that information out of the book? You kind of mentioned
that? The book does a good job. I could explain it to you, but that would require me reading the book aloud to you. So Rebecca Skloot, the author, is a science writer. This is one of her like things. She gotcha. Makes science of accessible to dum-dums like myself.
Dum-dums. So she is a good interpreter.
Yes. So she understands the science, and she's also done a ton of research and fact checking. So the back of this book is just like thick with notes and expert testimony. And here's where you can find this citation. So it's very scientifically rigorous.
So that's a satisfying book to read too, because you pick it up and you're like, oh my God, this book is so thick. But then you get like three quarters of the way through it and you're like, oh man, I'm done. Like, baby, I am done with this. Like, I'm not reading these notes.
There was a moment when I was like getting towards the end and I'm like, so the story is pretty clearly over, but there's a lot of book left. What's going to happen? Are the cells going to be like a mutation and attack? Yeah. But they weren't.
It's a medical journal.
Nick, so, I don't want to advocate for Ian here, but like, that is a really satisfying feeling when a book's like a surprise finish to a book. Yes.
Or like surprise. when a book has like an excerpt from the next book in the series.
You don't have to read that at all.
They didn't get her permission. This research becomes wildly successful
and worldwide.
And somehow they scientifically figure out how to do this, which I just have so many questions about, but that's fine. We could just move on because it's probably not the point of your book. So When did she find out?
She never did.
Oh, no. Henrietta.
She died.
It sounds like there's a clear ethical dilemma at the middle of this, which is like they used her cells without her permission, right?
I'd say in the beginning of this.
Yeah.
They didn't wait till the middle.
I would like to point out she was receiving free cancer treatment, right? Like this might just be the terms of service. She might have just like clicked through this without reading, right? Like this is the same reason that like Google can sell your data and Facebook. Like, isn't this us just selling Henrietta Lacks's data?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Though it's not the situation where if she had just read the fine print, she would have been okay. This is something that Skloot goes into pretty well. They didn't tell her what they were doing. And they also did some pretty dreadful cancer treatments, which were what they did at the time, but basically treatments which burned her body using radium. And so like she went along with all the medical advice because this is what you did in the 1950s, especially if you're a black person, you're not going to rock the boat.
You're
when
just
you're
along
getting
for the ride.
This medical care, you're going to say the doctor knows what they're doing. I'm going to just trust them, and we're going to roll with it. And if they tell me that my skin is going to become black and charred because of the radiation that's blasting through me every couple of days, I suppose it'll help.
Right. That's just how you fight cancer.
Her cancer killed her, and she never found out. She never found out that her cells had this huge effect.
Okay, so how common was that? Because I'm sure she wasn't the only one that ever happened to, right?
Right. Like, I'm guessing if you put up a sign that says free cancer treatment, I think a lot of people line up for it. And
right. Well, this is we've talked about Tuskegee here on the show. We've talked about Tuskegee before, and how part of the way the syphilis experiments worked at Tuskegee was there was the idea that there was some kind of free treatment being given out. The thing, what sets Henrietta Lacks apart is that, sure, people were sampled from, samples were taken pretty egregiously, and some pretty invasive experimental techniques were used, but none of them provided the culture that made a huge breakthrough, breakthroughs in medical development. Like,
yeah. So how did they? Yeah. Sorry, I just have been interrupting you. It's just so fascinating.
Oh, dude. Like, it gets better. It gets better. Okay.
Fascinating.
All right. It gets better.
We'll stop talking.
So her cells are proliferating. They're so common. At first, like, it was kind of like a good old boys club. And so if you had like the guy who was growing these at first, the first one to sort of culture these cells, he would just like, you would write him and say, hey, can I have some of those cells? And he would send you a tube. And gradually it got to the point where these cells became ubiquitous in labs around the world. So the guy who was in charge of sort of setting up the cell culturing.
He was working in a lab late one night.
Yeah, working in a lab late one night, and his eyes beheld a dreadful sight, this vial of tissue, and he put down on it four letters, H-E-L-A, because this is how he labeled his cell cultures, his tissue samples. The first two letters of the first name, the first two letters of the last name, HeLa. So he labeled it like that, and that is the only connection to Henrietta Lacks until, obviously, 2010 when this book came out. Henrietta Lacks disappeared from history. So as late as the 1990s, as late as the early 2000s, people thought that her name might be Helen Lane because all they had to go on was HeLa. H-E-L-A. Okay. Nobody knew who she was. Nobody knew who her family was. Nobody knew like her story at all.
There was no connection.
The woman whose body produced this thing, which became so essential for development of medicines and so forth, she, the person, disappeared. And her family didn't even know that her cells were doing life-saving work and research around the globe.
The mind doesn't think of that being the mind doesn't go, I wonder if that's her. Yeah.
You know what I suspect?
So the inevitable question is, how did they find out? And this didn't come out until 2010?
Well, so it started kind of seeping out in the 70s. Okay. So the first sort of like long form news journal articles, like think pieces were written about this in the 70s, misidentifying the names, but there started to be connections. The family, Henrietta Lacks's family, the rest, like her kids, she had five, six kids. Her kids, some of them are still alive today. There, people began sort of like saying, oh, your mother's cells are all over the world. But these are people who, several of them dropped out of school. None of them really got sort of a international level medical education. And so they didn't know what that meant. So people would come to them and say, oh yeah, your mother, Henrietta Lacks, she's a lifesaver. Her cells are out there. And they thought she had been cloned and was living in the United Kingdom.
Did they actually, I mean, that's a thing that they thought.
Yes.
That's not, you're not being hyperbolic.
No, I'm serious. This is like, so this is kind of the third.
So what, like doctors are approaching these people on the street? Or like, who is coming up to them? Like research scientists?
So sometimes it's like historians of science who have kind of like ferreted out the whole connection. This story wasn't widely known until 2010 when this book was published. So this is kind of the third strand of the book. The first
strand is...
Is that a DNA pun? What's that?
Is that a DNA pun?
Oh, yes. I definitely planned that DNA pun. The first strand of the book is...
1 point for DNA puns?
Yes.
Goes to Ian.
Down. Got that. I'm just going to make a note.
Ready there, Joe.
I am I'm getting all my DNA material ready.
Got it. Okay. Ooh, gross. So the first strand is her story, like actual Henrietta. Who is this woman? The second strand is the effect that this DNA material had on the world. The third is the drama of Henrietta Lacks's family.
Ooh,
so these are people
who are, that's what we want to hear, Ian.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Drama, baby.
They're living in poverty. They're dealing with mental illness. They're dealing with a variety of issues. They don't know what it means. People like say to them, there's this scamster who tries to take advantage of them and get them to sign over all their rights.
Oh,
they believe that like once they understand like what's going on, they're like, oh, well, that generates literal billions of dollars worldwide. Maybe could we have
some of it?
Could we have health insurance?
Right.
And so they try to go to various, like they go to Johns Hopkins, and Johns Hopkins is like, oh no, we were giving it away for free and we don't make any money off of it anymore. Goodbye now. Johns Hopkins has since
time
decided,
to lawyer up.
Well, yeah, like they tried. The problem is legally you can't really establish like a personal copyright over DNA. You can't establish like a right to that. There have been Supreme Court cases about this.
I made this, right? Like, I feel like I should have intellectual property over this.
Right. But it doesn't, like the precedent isn't there. So this is a family which never really knew their mom. She died before many of them were kind of old enough to know her. Her legacy has the potential to be huge, and no one knows her, and no one seems to care about her. They just care about her cells.
So is a lot of the book like picking up the pieces? That's what kind of it feels like.
So I referred to it at the top as a science mystery, and I think that's it. It's like there's the strong mystery element. Her research takes the form of like putting a puzzle together. It's putting a puzzle together. And one of the cool things about this book is that Skloot does her best to be sort of sensitive to Henrietta's legacy and to Henrietta's family. There's a moment when she finds a document in a hospital for the mentally ill, and it describes Henrietta using a word. And you read this, like Skloot says, it used a specific word to describe Henrietta's mental state. And you expect we're going to hear that word now. But then she narrates a conversation with Deborah, Henrietta's daughter. And Deborah says, please don't print that. Please don't put that word in. I don't like that word. Please don't put it in. And so the book doesn't include that word. It's like a historical detail that Skloot, as the historian, finds, but because she's being sensitive to like what this family wants and needs, she doesn't put that piece in.
Yeah, it's like a history of science empathetically told.
Well, this is like what they didn't do to her to her cells, right? She didn't have the chance to say no. She didn't have this chance to have privacy. Henrietta didn't. And so what Skloot's doing is like, yeah, I'm going to tell as much of the good stories as I can. And if there's dark stuff, I'll include that if it's not going to be hurtful to the family. But she tries to be kind of considerate of the family's needs. This is like, now, so Ian, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so I know we only bring downers on this podcast. So I'm assuming that the end of this book, there is little resolution or... It almost feels like the family does deserve something, right? I'm assuming they don't get that at all, right? I'm just guessing.
In the book, so the book ends with her, with her family, some of them passing away. They don't get the health insurance that they need. They don't get really much financial assistance.
Right. We weren't expecting them to. But no. Why would there be?
But
right?
They no. do. Okay, so one of the things that these people are, this family is really invested in is her legacy. And it's not so much like they would love, you know, a couple of billion dollars, but they would also really want people to know her. And so there are really beautiful moments throughout the book and throughout the kind of last half of the book where Skloot's work of bringing Henrietta Lacks's story to the front starts to pay off. And so the family, Deborah Lacks gets to speak at a conference or is about to speak at a conference honoring Henrietta Lacks for her contributions to global research science. And there are these sweet moments of discovery when the family is like, oh, wow, that's a picture of her. Wow, mm-hmm. We haven't seen one of those in a long time, this kind of thing. And since the book was published, there have been a variety of things, initiatives done to boost her legacy. So there is an asteroid named after her. She got an
that's where I would have started too.
That's the dream.
Well, we got to name an asteroid after, obviously. That's where we start.
She got a posthumous honorary doctorate. And Johns Hopkins has started doing things to kind of make up for the fact that their doctors took her.
Right?
Took
yeah, her to make DNA up for the asking. Bad PR is what they started making up for.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so her DNA, her tissue was used against her will, or not even against her will, but against her just like...
Without her knowledge.
Knowledge. Yeah. Totally outside of her knowledge. Couldn't you argue that like, hey, this has gone on to scientific discovery. This has gone on to good thing. Like her impact on the world has been tremendous, whether or not she acknowledged it or not, or was made aware of it or not. Like, isn't that kind of a good thing, Ian? Like
probably
sure.
The bright spot in this book, right?
You rob her of agency at this point, but like the greater good far, far, far outweighs consent at this point.
Well, I'm not going to go on the record as saying things outweigh consent, but I see what you're saying. I think Joe...
I don't know if that's how I would have worded it, but I get Joe's point.
I would agree. I would agree that like the benefit that these cells have had on modern medicine has been tremendous, but it kind of... We can't say like her cells. That phrase, her cells, makes no sense when we don't know who she was. Like, without a sense of this woman, this mother of several, many children, she struggled through poverty and hardship and abuse and pain and really, really dreadful kind of treatment experiences. Unless we know who she is, there is no she. So I think I would agree, yes, that is a legacy, but also her name needs to be known. Without this book is part of her legacy. And I think if this book didn't exist, if this book were taken away, then we would be still thinking her name was Helen Lane or something.
Yeah. No, we wouldn't know it at all.
No, right. I mean, we'd have no idea. And John Hopkins wouldn't be naming anything after anybody.
Exactly.
That's right.
So then I guess that was my other point here is like, hey, isn't this almost like the best of both worlds. Like, we know her story. We know Henrietta Lacks' story. Like, she's kind of seen as this posthumous hero. She's had this tremendous impact. Like, your author has, like, brought this story to everyone's awareness. It seems like everything turned out fine, Ian.
I think the best of both worlds would be they just asked her.
I think dream scenario, they asked her and then they paid her kids a bunch of money.
Yeah, I think that would have been a better both worlds. It seems like they probably still do this.
Right. So
it seems like there's no way that this is the only person or only case.
This is kind of like the broader, and I know you always like to ask about the overt message, and then I'm going to stop after I talk about this.
I think I know what
the
overt message is.
Yeah.
I can throw you another softball if you want.
I'll talk about the overt message. Here we go.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
This book is very interested in, is going to sound dry, but it's actually really interesting, sort of the ethics of informed consent and the ethics of them taking your scraps and keeping them. And she has this long afterword where she goes into kind of the philosophical, the ethical, and the scientific perspectives on if you go to the hospital and if you get, I don't know, your kidney out or something, does the hospital have to say, we're going to keep your kidney and do experiments on it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think they do.
Well, so hospitals would say, as soon as we start doing that, people start turning it down, and then we end up, it's really expensive to do that stuff, and it impedes the march of progress and so on and so forth.
Well, aren't they the worst?
and other sort of health establishment voices would say, let's just keep it as it is. Most people don't care. Like, if you don't know that your kidney is being experimented on, who cares?
Yeah. So I always really like the idea of donating your body to science after you die. Like, it just feels like a very altruistic thing. But one time, we had a staff development where we went to a local technical college. And,
Oh, shit. I know what you're about to say.
Yeah, it was great. It was the best staff development we ever had. We got to choose our own adventure at this local technical college. And I signed up for the cadaver lab because that just seemed amazing to me, right?
That's a rookie move.
No, it was amazing. It's still one of the cooler things I've done. In the cadaver lab, they have cadavers, as you would expect, but there was three tanks in this small room, and they raised them out of this formaldehyde or alcohol. I'm not exactly sure what they store them in. And there's three bodies there in various states of dissection. And these are all presumably people who donated their bodies to science. Okay. But the one guy I remember, the guy that I spent the most time with, he was like partially dissected, et cetera. He had been dead for 20 years. For 20 years, his body had been like in this cadaver lab, like helping these students like learn, these technical students learn. And somehow it struck me then that like, when I say I want to donate my body to science, in a cadaver lab at a local technical college isn't what I have in mind. What I have in mind is I want my cells to cure cancer, not cadaver lab local tech.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to go down the path towards, because they also do other crazy things with cadavers, like, oh, you're on the display at a museum.
Yeah.
For the next 200 years naked.
Forever.
Or that guy that they cut in half a bunch of times.
Not sure
who I'm talking about. You know who I'm talking about. Oh. That museum where they slice them up.
Oh yeah,
like a cheese grater.
Yeah,
I don't want that. There should be additional boxes to check.
Oh sure, like
not
like
on public display. That'd be one I would check.
Yeah, but
don't do anything with my wiener.
The Body Worlds exhibit, which tours the world.
That's the one.
I do think that's what Nick was talking about when he said the guy that was sliced up with a cheese grater.
Right. I don't want to be in Body Worlds.
Well, you don't get to check that box. It's just yes or no.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're from, they were executed political prisoners from China.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Wait, that's Body Works? That's Body World?
Yes, Body Worlds.
What? Yes. There's no way that they give consent to that.
I should tell my mom that because she
they consented to being executed for political crimes.
Okay.
You know what? I think so. Hey, let me end. I'm way out of time. Let me end this strange conversation on a fun little note. So This is a story. This is a story about sort of donating your body with full knowledge and consent and the weirdness that can lead to in the world. There was a Polish pianist named Andrzej Tchaikowski, and Tchaikowski was a composer. He was a piano player. He was well known, performed all over Europe, and died in 1982. And in his will, he left his body to science, and he donated his skull to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And he said, I want you to use my skull as a prop on stage in a Shakespeare play. Specifically, famously, in Hamlet, Hamlet holds up a skull and talks to it. And nobody really wanted to do this with this skull because it was delivered to the RSC. And eventually, there was a production starring David Tennant in 2008, and he used the real skull. Now, this came out in the press, and the Royal Shakespeare Company said, oh, we're not going to use the real skull. It'll be too distracting in the performances. It'll be a prop. But in fact, they did end up using it throughout the whole the run of the show in London.
Sweet.
As well as a television adaptation, which you can still see today. So sometimes that guy got his wish. You know,
yeah.
26 years later, his skull was toted around on stage by David Tennant.
That's pretty cool. One time I went to a scrapyard, like where you get rid of cars, and there was an urn of ashes on top of the Coke machine. And when I asked them about it, they said that somebody had just left it in the car and they didn't know what to do with it.
Oh, my goodness.
I feel like those two stories are the same thing.
Well, maybe.
Maybe. All right. Well, that sounds morally complex. Joe.
Oh, man.
Your book, I feel like, is going to be much more fun.
Yes. Well, it's certainly more optimistic. Nick, do you have a soundboard?
Welcome to March Madness.
I didn't know that this podcast had a budget for a soundboard. I would like to put in for one.
Welcome to March Madness.
April 6th.
Oops. Next week, guys, do you want to talk about basketball?
It will require that I learn about basketball between now and then.
Okay, so good. I assume it's March Madness is over, but I assume you guys have been taking diligent notes and learning a lot about it. So I feel like now that you've done that, maybe you could bring me some basketball books.
Bracketology.
Ian just had a stroke.
Live on air. No, definitely. I would bring that. I would do. You bet, buddy. I'll bring. Well, here's the thing. Okay.
All right.
I've read some conspiracy theories that say that Kobe Bryant was the only thing standing between the United States and coronavirus. And when he passed away, his powers failed. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, he passed away right before we kind of went into lockdown. So in honor of Kobe Bryant, I'm going to bring his best-selling, probably best-selling in part because he passed away, but his best-selling basketball memoir slash philosophy book, The Mamba Mentality.
Ooh, that's fun to say.
And don't you dare make jokes about Mambo number 6, because that's disrespectful to Kobe's legacy.
Okay. We'll try our best.
Wait, that sounds okay. Like, that sounds okay, Nick. But the problem is that everybody knows that no players would be great without great coaches behind them. And
that's absolutely not true. What are you talking about?
Book. Yes. Well, we'll talk about it next week. I'm going to talk about one of the most famous coaches in basketball history, a guy named John Wooden. And he wrote like 50 books. I was trying to figure out what like the best or most famous one was. And I have selected a book called They Call Me Coach, John Wooden, on life, basketball, and I don't know.
And life.
And life.
Do you think they call him coach because he's the coach?
They called me coach, so I started doing the job. It's just I was carrying the clipboard.
Which came first, the coach or the coaching?
You guys should have brought a book by Vince Lombardi. That would have been cool, too.
Well, he's not basketball.
Whatever. He's a coach.
Uh-huh.
But the theme wasn't coaches.
This is how themes get muddy. This is how themes get muddy when we both show up with Vince Lombardi books for basketball week.
That's minus 2 points for Ian. No book about coaches. Hey, Joseph.
Yes.
I'm really excited to hear about your book. Can you tell me about it?
Nick, let me tell you about Becoming by Michelle Obama. First of all, so Ian brought a book this week about somebody that we haven't really heard that much about, right? Like nobody really knows about Henrietta Lacks.
It's almost the whole premise, yeah.
Right. Well, hey, everybody knows about Michelle Obama. She's
okay.
She's a big deal. So,
do you want some points for that?
Yeah. If I could get like a point or like towards a point, that'd
be
great.
Wait, you don't get points for Michelle Obama being well known?
Well,
I think you get
Nick
to make that
decides
decision.
Where
yeah,
the points
that's
go
on me, buddy. So, yeah, guess what, Joe? 2 points.
Oh, two Obama points. All right. So, I mean, I don't know what to say about
keep
Michelle
it up
Obama.
Here.
She's obviously most
Joe?
Famous for being. Yes,
Joe.
Yes.
If you win, you are contractually obligated to say thanks, Obama, for your win. And if you do not, I don't know what's going to happen. It'll be bad.
We know who Michelle Obama is. She is most famous for being First Lady of the United States. What blew me away when I read this book, though, is I had like a pretty good sense that she was accomplished besides being the First Lady of the United States and besides being like defined through her husband, Barack, which is what we know her for. I was blown away just by how accomplished and how impressive Michelle Obama is. This book is not a political book. Like it's not a political book outside of the fact that it exists in an obviously political realm. It's a personal story of like a woman who's never really thought of herself as a politician. And I really dug it.
Now, Joe, I'm a raging Republican. Am I going to like this book?
Based on the Amazon reviews I read, I'm going to think no. I think you're probably
you think
gonna
all the
talk
one-star reviews are just from Republicans.
There's things about like conspiracy theories and deep state, and yeah,
okay. Keep talking. I'm going to find some one-star reviews. By a bunch of idiots.
Oh dear.
All right, Joe. Tell me about your book while I try to find the worst one-star review I can possibly imagine.
I will listen as Nick frantically Googles and doesn't really pay attention.
All right. So Ian, I'm just going to speak to you for
the
next 20
minutes. You know what? Okay. I won't look any further. I found this one very easily. One-star review by Kathleen. Did not read. Prefer to follow Melania. First off.
So that is, let's be clear. That is a one-star review on the existence of the book.
Yeah. Did not read. I just prefer a different person. Does she have a book? Oh, Melania does have a book. Melania Trump, Elegance in the White House. It's not her book, though. It's just it's a picture book. It's a photo collection.
Oh, dear.
Her outfits in the White House. Okay, so what a great comparison. Okay, so on both sides of the aisle, some strong competition. Joe, tell us about your book.
Okay. So Michelle Obama has a super impressive resume. Some of this might be back or news to you. Some of it might not be. It was, I'd like to establish a little bit of background though.
I would love that, Joe.
Michelle Obama grew up firmly, like, I don't even want to say middle class. I think firmly working class. Her father worked for the city sanitation department. Her mother was a stay-at-home mother. Michelle Obama excelled in school. She had an older brother who also excelled in school. Went to some magnet schools. She grew up on the south side of Chicago, went to some magnet schools, and eventually would go on to get not one Ivy League degree from Princeton, but then famously go to Harvard Law School and get her second Ivy League degree.
Yeah. Nice. Well, one is so dated.
Right.
You know what
I mean?
You
can't just get one.
Yeah.
Right.
Did she grow up in Chicago? Is that
in Chicago. She actually tells a story after she started working at this high-powered law firm in Chicago. She said she had this great office and she could see the neighborhood where she grew up in from that office. Like, you, it's
so
pretty
satisfying.
Well, no, she talks about it as like sad. Like, she talks about,
and that's like, the difference between Nick and Michelle Obama.
that's the only one difference. So yeah, she talks about like being on like she's super successful at her law firm. She talks about herself as a box checker her entire life. Like, she just wanted to achieve and be the best. And like, what's the next step? What am I supposed to do next? So she goes to this high powered law firm. She is on track to be a partner. She's doing like a lot of work, but a lot of good work, not particularly like soul nourishing work, but a lot of good work. And she says that from her window, she could see Lake Michigan and then in the distance, the neighborhood that she grew up in. And she said, while I was working there, I never felt more disconnected from that neighborhood. Like, that neighborhood might as well have been on the other side of the planet. Mm. So she does kind of an interesting thing, and that is she leaves her job as a lawyer and she starts pursuing public service as work. She becomes an assistant to the mayor of Chicago. She does that for a while. She goes off to become an executive director of a nonprofit called Public Allies, which is just essentially this nonprofit encouraging intelligent young people to go into public service. And then she becomes eventually the associate dean of student services at the University of Chicago. And basically leads this life of public service until Barack Obama's life gets so, essentially until he runs for president. And once he runs for president, she goes off to become a full-time, you know, supporter of a person, of a husband running for president.
Yeah, I guess how much of the book is about that and how much of the book is just about her and her life?
Yep, so the book's split into thirds. The first third, the name of the book is Becoming. The first section, the first book in the book, the first section of the book is called Becoming Me. And the first, about third of the book is about her growing up, her grandparents, her parents, her education, up through law school.
Okay.
The second part of the book is called Becoming Us. Barack Obama shows up really early in the second part of the book, and it talks about their romance, their courtship, I guess their meeting first. She was his mentor at the law firm.
She was his mentor?
Yeah, so this is kind of cool.
So like basically everything Barack did was she's responsible for.
So like he can be like, I was a two-term president of the United States. And she's like, well, yeah, but I was your mentor. So there's that. She was his mentor. She had graduated Harvard Law School. He had actually just finished his first year and he had an internship at the law firm that she worked at. And she was assigned to him. And she basically like took him out, like they had, like she was in charge of his social life more or less at this law firm. So she would drive him around in her Saab and bring him to company parties and like social hours and things like that. And you know, oldest story in the world, right? Like mentor, mentee, high powered law firm, Harvard graduates, and they fell for one another.
Tale
as old as time.
I'm genuinely curious whenever I hear stuff like this. She seems like an incredibly accomplished but also very busy person. Did she write this book or is there a ghostwriter?
Super good question. I looked into this a little bit because this is a really cleanly written book. Like, it's an engaging story, well told throughout. I thought huge amounts of this book were unputdownable. Apparently, she did have the help of a ghostwriter. I don't know to what extent that was.
Did they have to kill
that person? That person has since been killed.
No one knows. Yes.
That's how they get the term ghostwriter, because once they write it, they have to kill them and they're a ghost.
That's exactly it.
And so, when does he get the flaming skull and the motorcycle?
Almost immediately.
Okay. So it goes like this. Michelle Obama reaches out to somebody.
Yes. Yep.
They write the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then a murder happens and they turn into a harbinger of justice.
That's correct.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
Tale
thank you.
As old as time. What's interesting about this book? Because I assume it's not just like, is it like 500 pages of her accomplishments?
That would be super boring. That'd be a terrible book. So the first, like I said, first third of the book is her like education and coming up. Second part of the book is basically, and then I met Barack and this is how my life changed because of it. And then the third part of her book is pretty firmly in the White House. And I will say the third section of the book kind of is, and these were my accomplishments. And I think that's okay. Where the book tails off a little bit. I think it gets less interesting at that point. Impressive still, right? Like, but less interesting.
Is that the whole book though? Is it whole? Is it like, I'm impressive, or is it,
you can do this too.
Yeah. What's the overt message to some degree, but like also like what are you getting out of this book?
Okay.
Is it just that she's fucking awesome?
No.
Which, like, let's be clear.
That she's awesome.
That's fine. Is,
right. Like, I think know. A lot of people write autobiographies where it's like, and then I was awesome. But no, that's not what this is about. In fact, this is very much about like Ian was alluding to earlier. Hey, you can do this too. Like, right. I have led, Michelle Obama says, right, over the course of 500 pages, I've led a pretty exceptional life. Like, my life by any metric is like a pretty dope life. But I want to be totally clear. Like, was I capable? Like, am I capable? Yes, absolutely. But there are thousands of kids on the south side of Chicago who are just as capable as I was. The difference between me and them is I was put in the right room. Like, my parents made sure that I was at the magnet school. My parents made sure that I was applying to Princeton. My and then eventually I made sure that I applied to Harvard Law School. And when I got waitlisted at Harvard Law School, right, like, and then eventually got in, right, like, I made the most of absolutely every opportunity I was given, right? Like, I think that's the overt message here.
Is she a hard worker or is she just brilliant? Or both.
So she never comes out. She never comes out and says, driven. I'm brilliant. She is an incredibly hard worker.
I guess you don't have to answer the brilliant question because she's obviously brilliant. But like, what, I guess, where does she credit it?
So the phrase that she uses throughout is she uses the phrase,
her parents?
I'm a box checker. Right? Like, if I knew there was something to strive for, like if I knew there was something on the horizon and I knew there was a path to get there, I made sure I checked off every single box to get there, which is kind of funny because when Barack Obama comes into the book, and I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about him, it's so obvious that he does not live that life. Like, Barack Obama comes in this book and he seems more like he seems more brilliant in the sense of the word, in the sense that we would use that term. Like, he's naturally charismatic. He's incredibly intellectual. She talks about him like, she goes and sees this apartment that he's subletting when he's working at this law firm. And she said the only thing that was in it was thrift store furniture. And then every surface was covered with open books and magazines and periodicals. Like, it was like, it's just like this vacuum of information.
I always get really annoyed when I hear about really smart people. Cause it's just like, man, how do they stay so focused? And like, you can do that on a weekend, sure, but they do it constantly. And that's why they're better than us.
Nonstop. So, Nick, you asked what the most interesting part of this book was. I think there's a lot of really fun stuff in this book. And like, some of the most enjoyable stuff in this book is like the little peeks behind the scene that you get at life in the White House, or what it's like to have like daughters who have Secret Service agents going with them to prom and stuff like that. Okay. Right?
All right. But, sure.
But I thought the best stuff, like the thing that I spent the most time thinking about while I was reading this book, is there's this crazy tension in it, in that Michelle Obama, if she had never met Barack Obama, like, would have been incredibly successful in her life. Like, she is so far along this path, like, by the time she meets Barack Obama. But then she meets, falls in love with, and marries this guy who's like, aura or career or path is totally going to envelop her own, right? Like, there's no way it doesn't, like, at a certain point. Like, once he's running for president of the United States, like, once he gives his 2004 keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention, like, that's a train that they can't get
off.
It's
a runaway train.
It absolutely is. And the tension that you feel here of, like, Michelle Obama is this crazy intelligent, crazy accomplished, crazy focused person, and she's like swept away on the Obama train, right, is kind of tough. And in some ways, I don't know if your heart like breaks for her because she has this tremendous life, right? But in so many ways, it feels like how do I say this?
Nobody help him.
In so many ways, it feels like her life isn't about her at a certain point, which is like,
right.
Right. Like, it's not about her at a certain point, but at the same time, like, well, of course it's not. Like, it's in service to like this larger thing, which is kind of cool and kind of fine, but it also like kind of sucks if you're Michelle Obama.
Yeah, sure. Are those her words? Probably not.
Well, this is my question. Like, is this, I think I know the answer, but Joe, you're not saying like the book is Michelle working out her regrets for, you know, being married to the guy who happens to be the first black president of the United States.
No. Like,
so this is like kind of one of the things that we see. She is a person who could have maybe still could be president herself.
Really funny. She explicitly answers that question in this book. In the final chapter, she said, "Hey, I get this question absolutely all the time. I'm going to answer it right here definitively. I have no intention of ever running for president of the United States." And then she goes on to say, which is something true throughout the whole thing. She's like, "I don't like politics." Right? Mm. Like, I would prefer to not, like, I understand that politics is an engine. I understand that politics is an actual way to change the world. She said, but I've seen too much behind the curtain of politics. I think it's too messy. I think it's too gross. I have zero intention of putting my family through that again.
Right. Maybe, though, that was the ghostwriter.
Oh, maybe the ghostwriter was saying doesn't plan on politics. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. So, like, I think that's the most interesting part is her, like, this tension that she feels. There's this kind of great scene where Barack Obama becomes a senator, not a state senator, but like a real legit senator at one point. And Michelle gets this phone call.
To all the state senators out there, we think you're legit, yep. I guess.
Right.
Not all of them.
Well, okay. We think you're pretty legit, but I will say that this is very clearly described as a promotion in the book when Obama goes from state senator to actual senator. His words are not actual senator. But Michelle gets this phone call from another senator's wife inviting her to join. And this is kind of cryptic, but it's like this secret club. She invites Michelle Obama to join this secret club. And when Michelle asks about it, she's like, "Oh, well, it's just like the wives and spouses of these like high-powered people in Washington. And we just get together and we have dinner and we talk about issues. And like, it's just like this great club to like essentially network and get to know people. It's kind of a who's who club." And Michelle says, "Well, that's fine. I really appreciate the invite, but I'm not moving to Washington." Right? Like, I live in Chicago. I have this career in Chicago. And Michelle writes, she says, "The senator's wife paused, letting this delicate beat pass. And when she spoke again, her voice was gentle. 'That can be very hard on a marriage, you know,' she said. Families fall apart." And Michelle says, "I felt her judgment then." Mm. She had been in Washington for many years, and the implication was that she had seen things go poorly when a spouse stayed back. The implication was that I was making a dangerous choice, that there was only one correct way to be a senator's wife, and I was choosing wrong." Huh. And yeah, like there's this crazy, like Michelle Obama has to balance being who she is with being a senator and then president's wife. And I think that's the most interesting stuff in this book.
Huh. That sounds good. Ian, what should the lit heads do?
Well, I would say get good exercise, eat healthy.
Vegetables.
Eat your vegetables.
What about vegetables?
Yeah, okay, vegetables are good. You know, shop local. And also, if you're interested support in shopping local, head on over to our social media streams at You Don't Know Lit on Twitter Instagram and Facebook, and recommend a book for us or tell us how we did. Head over to youdontknowlitpodcast.com, which is our website, and suggest a book or a theme there. We would appreciate that.
Fantastic. Ian, you lose. Only because I like to hear about wildly successful people. I like to surround myself.
More successful than your cells are all over the world.
I feel like this is bad for next week when you talk about Kobe Bryant and I talk about a basketball coach that Nick has never heard of.
You never know. Joe, read us something.
Yeah, this is from the epilogue, which, boy, I like a good prologue, and I like a good epilogue even better. Mm. And here she's talking about kind of her pride in the work that she's done. And well, that's it. She says, there are portraits of me and Barack now hanging in the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, a fact that humbles us both. I doubt that anyone looking at our two childhoods, our circumstances, would ever have predicted we would land in those halls. The paintings are lovely, but what matters most is that they're there for young people to see. That our faces help dismantle the perception that in order to be enshrined in history, you have to look a certain way. If we belong, then so too can many others. I'm an ordinary person who found herself on an extraordinary journey. In sharing my story, I hope to help create space for other stories and other voices to widen the pathway for who belongs and why. I've been lucky enough to walk in stone castles, urban classrooms, Iowa kitchens, just trying to be myself, just trying to connect. For every door that's been opened to me, I've tried to open another one to many others, and here is what I have to say finally. Let's invite one another in. Maybe then we can begin to fear less, to make fewer wrong assumptions, to let go of the biases and stereotypes that unnecessarily divide us. Maybe we can better embrace the ways that we are all the same. It's not about being perfect. It's not about where you get yourself in the end. There's power in allowing yourself to be known and be heard and in owning your unique story and using your authentic voice. And there's grace in being willing to know and to hear others. This, for me, is how we become.